offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have this pleasure of joining you on this beautiful Thursday morning from our studios at the Sri Satya Sai Media Center at Prashanthi Nilayam. This is a program where together we explore the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse. We do it with the help of Swami's literature, the Gita Vahini specifically, and the many discourses where Swami has spoken about the Bhagavad Gita. And personally, it's been an enriching journey for me, and from the responses I've got from a few of you, I think some of you enjoy it as much as I enjoy it. And it is our pleasure to be able to spend time contemplating on some of these truths that this sacred scripture reveals through the words of Lord Shri Krishna himself, and elaborated even further by Swami. Because even as we go through these verses in the Bhagavad Gita, and simultaneously when I go through what Swami says in the Gita Vahini, in many places, like we will see even in this week's episode, Swami reveals some of the inner workings of Arjuna's mind. The Bhagavad Gita as such is a composition by sage Vedavyasa, and it is a very poetic verse. It's a poetic work. So when Swami writes about it, Swami breaks it even further and says that at this point Arjuna had this doubt, and that is why Krishna said this. And when Krishna said this, Arjuna could not understand or grasp the meaning of that. So Krishna further elaborated. In that manner, Swami even reveals to us some of the inner workings of Arjuna's mind and Krishna's inner intent. I don't think anybody else, any other author, will be able to give us insights such as these other than the Lord himself. And Swami had told Dr. Hislop once, when he was in a conversation, and Dr. Hislop said, "Swami, from the times of Krishna to now," and Swami abruptly cut him off and said, "I am Krishna. Where is time?" And I think that is the experience we are having when we are going through this Bhagavad Gita, because he is Krishna. Where is time? We are in that battlefield of Kurukshetra. We are standing before him with folded hands, and he, in all his mercy and love, is revealing these truths of greatest secrecy to us. And we cannot be grateful enough for this beautiful blessing that Swami is giving us. We will begin with a short summary of what we covered last time. We are in the 8th chapter. We covered 2 shlokas last time. I think we'll be covering only 2 more shlokas today. We've been going a little slow for the past few weeks because what Krishna is saying here is very, very coded in a sense. And it requires us to dwell deep into what he is saying. And it is of immense importance, as we saw in the past few weeks. Because previously Krishna had said, "Whoever thinks of me at the time of passing reaches me, and there is absolutely no doubt about this." So this is why it is so relevant to us. How can we ensure that we are in the thoughts of the Lord in those last few moments of our life? In the 7th verse that we covered last week, Krishna says, "Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu ma manusmara yudhyacha." Because thinking of me will, in those last moments, will bring you to me. Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mam anusmara yudhyacha. Therefore, at all times, think of me and fight. We discussed what this anusmara means. One who is in constant remembrance of the Lord. And the other meaning is one who is in the right remembrance. The remembrance, the contemplation is in line with the description of the Lord as given in the scriptures. And we will talk about that more today too. And this command, mam anusmara yudhyacha, yudhya or fight, is an instruction that is specific to Arjuna, as he was faced with the duty of fighting in the battle. But the command is more generic because it means take on whatever is the duty of your life, of your station in life at that moment, and take on that struggle, right? That's what it means, yudhyacha. But when you're doing it, do it constantly contemplating on the Lord. A method for that is given in the very next line, where Krishna says, Mai arpitam mano buddhi, offering to me your mind and intellect. That way, you will be able to think of me all through your life, not necessarily at every moment, right? But your life will be like the river which is being guided towards that final consummation, towards that supreme union. In the next verse, the eighth one, Krishna says that this focus can be attained through practice, abhyasa yoga. He says, abhyasa yoga yuktena chetasa, with a mind made steadfast through abhyasa yoga. Such a mind does not go seeking anything else, and hence seeks the supreme and reaches the supreme. Paramam purusham divyam yati, reaches that paramam purusham divyam. We discussed the significance of Krishna calling this the abhyasa yoga, because this term abhyasa was discussed in the previous chapter, in one of the previous chapters where Krishna spoke about dhyana. And there he had said the nature of the mind is to scatter in all directions. The one who is trying to meditate has got to do this abhyasa of constantly bringing the mind back to where it must be focused on. In the same way, doing that through the course of life is what is referred to as abhyasa yoga in this portion. And Krishna says, abhyasa yogena chetasa, with the mind that has been disciplined in this manner through abhyasa yoga, you will be able to follow this instruction of sarveshu kaleshu mam anusmara yudhyaja. And as I said, this is a very, very critical message that Krishna is giving us. Swami is reiterating, taking it out of this Bhagavad Gita and giving it to us and reminding us. And I just happened to come across a very beautiful episode regarding this instruction that Krishna is giving here, and I thought it would be most befitting to share with all of you at this point. And I think that is another way in which Swami silently guides each one of our actions, be it even this program. I know this gentleman, not personally, but I've known that he's been around for quite some time, is one Mr. Rommel, a very, very inspiring person, a person whom we have a lot of respect for. Even today I see him when I'm going back after work late in the evening. I see him coming back after doing some seva in some village, some Narayan seva, some Gram seva, and he'll be coming back. And he's well beyond 70 and very, very inspiring person, a Sevadal member, an Indian Forest Service officer who's been an ambassador to many countries representing India. But at heart, he is always a Swami Sevadal in his own explanation of who he is. And he lives true to that belief every day. So I've seen him around. We all know him. We've had conversations with him in Radio Sai. We've had articles about him. But Swami willed that I should listen to this particular episode just a couple of days back, even as we are going through this portion of the Bhagavad Gita. And I take it as Swami's command that it should be shared in this portion. And not only for embellishing the program on radio that I'm doing, but this episode is so beautifully reiterates and drives home. For me, it was a message that was so profound. When you hear it from a devotee, it makes a lot of difference. And of course, I'm not telling you the experience and I'm just going around. I will tell you what really happened. So this is what Rommel sir shared. It was the year 1992. He was, I think, at that point, the passport officer in Hyderabad. And he was supposed to go on a deputation to another country. I don't recall which one now. So his doctor told him that, you know, you have this particular health issue that you need to have a surgery for. And now you're going abroad. Why don't you get this done and then go, so that you don't have to worry about it when you are out of the country? So he agreed, he went in for the surgery, and when he was on the operation table, when he was put under anesthesia, he had this experience of him experiencing death, right? He could see that his life was leaving the body, and he said he could sense something like a countdown, and he knew that that countdown was leading to that point where the life is going to leave this body completely. So he was literally experiencing his death. And at that moment, this thought that I should be thinking about Swami because this is my last moment. And even as that countdown was thumping and his heart was beating, and he said, I have to think of Swami, I have to think of Swami. And he said, every thought other than that of Swami was rushing to his mind. He was thinking about his family. He was thinking about his work that was left incomplete. He was thinking about his house. He was thinking about all the other affairs that he was busy with. And to give you a context, this person, though he was in government service, he was leading a life of immense seva, right? He said that he had converted his office into a samiti, literally. Like all of them were Swami's devotees, and they would do bhajans together. They would go out on weekends and do seva. And whenever he would get an opportunity, wherever, whichever country he went to, he would start bhajans. He would have balvikas in his house. And he leads a life of a typical person who constantly thinks of Swami and has given himself to Swami seva. And such a person, he thought that in those last moments, it will be quite an easy task to recollect Swami. And he said, as the countdown was ticking, he just could not recall Swami. And he was becoming desperate. And in the last few moments, he just had a flash of thoughts about Prashanthi Nilayam, those good old sand days, the mandir. The moment he pictured Prashanthi Nilayam, he felt that Swami appeared there, literally caught his hand and brought him back into the body. Did not let the life leave that body. And then Swami explained to him. Swami said, you thought, right, that it must be very easy to think of Swami because you've done so much seva, you've been doing Swami's work for so long, you've been taking Swami's name for so many years. And Swami very lovingly explained to him, Swami said, it is not so easy. Swami said, in every anu, in every atom of your body, Swami and Swami's name should have percolated. You should have become one with that name and form. Only then, in those last moments, you can think of Swami, not otherwise. Even though you have done all this, Swami said, it is still not possible. Because you should have become one with God to be able to think of God in those last moments. Because when Krishna says you will merge with God, that's the ultimate, right? And that ultimate doesn't come so easily. It is the greatest achievement. And Swami said, Anu Anulo Swami should have entered your being, and that is when you can think of me. And Swami said, you're still not there, so I'm extending your life so that you can make those efforts. And boy, has he made efforts. Such an inspiring person, such an inspiring gentleman. And it's a lesson for each one of us, even as we are going through these portions of the Gita, where Krishna says, Mam Anusmara Yudhyacha. Let us remember, Swami has given us such examples to understand how difficult it is. You could have been a sevadal for 30 years. I could have been a student for so many years. I could be working in Radio Sai for so many years. But unless Swami becomes a part of my life breath, it is not going to be possible to remember him. What happens after that, after death? I mean, let's leave it to Swami. Let him take a call of what he wants to do with us. But can there be a more beautiful end to this life than to remember him and recall him in those last moments? And this episode, let us always keep it in our mind. It is not easy. How much ever we might think that we have spent our time thinking of Swami, no. Swami said, when you're alive, you should have come to that point where every atom of your body is calling out to the Lord. Only then, in those final moments, prayana kale, as the Gita says, at the time of that final journey, you will be able to call out to Swami. That's why I thought I'll share with you that beautiful experience where Swami has given these experiences to devotees, and they are living with us, right? These are not people whom we read about in scriptures. They are living with us. Even the other day I happened to walk past this gentleman, and just a couple of days back, there was a Telugu talk uploaded in our Telugu channel, and that's how I happened to hear this episode. So Swami has given experiences such as this to people around us to drive home this message, not to waste this life where we are aware of Swami, this life must not be wasted. With that, we'll go to the next shloka that we have for today. We'll go to shloka number 9. As always, we'll listen to it in the voice of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a brief meaning of that shloka, and then we will see what Krishna says there.
Kavim Puranam Anushasitaram Anoraniyam Samanusmaredyaha Sarvasya Dhataram Achintya Rupam Aditya Varnam Tamasav Parastat.
He who meditates on the omniscient, the ancient, the ruler, the subtler than the subtle, the ordainer of everything, of inconceivable form, effulgent like the sun, and beyond all darkness. So as you can see, it is an incomplete statement. This is only one part of the shloka, one part of the sentence that Krishna is saying. But nevertheless, we'll take a break here because there is so much in this that needs to be spoken about and discussed. So this was the 9th verse of the 8th chapter. Just to go back a little, we ended the previous week with a quote from Gita Vahini where Swami explains why it is difficult for the mind to have thoughts of God in the last moments. And the mind must be prepared. It must go through a process of discipline training, and that is what is referred to as yoga. And when the mind is put through such yoga, the mind begins to let go of whatever other things it holds on to, which it had to hold on to because that is how life is led, right? But as we are progressing in life, this has to be in a very natural way let go of. And that yoga which prepares you for that is what is being spoken about in this shloka and the few to follow. And that is referred to as anusmarana. It not only means constant contemplation, but it also means thinking of God the way He has to be thought about, right? As I said, if you think of God as another person, just like you and me, in our anger, in our internal fights with Swami, sometimes we ask, you know, Swami, don't you have daya? Don't you have compassion? Swami, how can you be so heartless? Swami, how can you do this to a person like this who is so good? Or how can you let somebody get away like this who has done bad? All of these are signs that we are not seeing God the way He ought to be seen. And I'm saying this with the full confession that we all do this mistake, right? We all question Swami's compassion. We all question Swami's judgment. It means that we are seeing Swami as just another person in our life. That is why this anusmarana, which also means thinking of God in line with His true nature as discovered and discussed in the scriptures, becomes very, very important. Swami says that is why Krishna goes on to describe God through some profound phrases in this particular shloka. To be precise, 8 phrases Krishna uses, or 8 terminologies Krishna uses to describe God, and He says this is how God has to be contemplated upon. And these shlokas, this one and the next one specifically, have direct references to the Upanishads. If I'm not wrong, I believe some of the sentences are directly out of the Upanishads, like Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the Kathopanishad. This is a very significant fact because the Upanishads themselves stand for an understanding that comes as a result of very deep inquiry. So Krishna is referring to the same descriptions and in a way validating the experience and understandings of these sages who have described God in this manner. But before we go into these descriptions, these 8 terminologies, there is one point Swami makes in Gita Vahini which I wanted to read out. Swami says there are 3 ways in which God can be contemplated on or contemplated as. The one is without qualities, without form, nirguna, nirakara. The second is with qualities, without form, saguna, nirakara. And the third being with qualities, and with form as Saguna Sakara. And Swami writes that Krishna tells Arjuna that the description of God that he is about to give him in this particular shloka that we heard is going to be related to the second category, that is Saguna Nirakara, with qualities but without form. This is interesting because Nirguna Nirakara cannot be contemplated upon at all. There should be some quality or some form for the mind to contemplate on something, right? It is impossible to contemplate on Nirguna Nirakara. It is also interesting because Krishna says, contemplate on God as having qualities but not a form, right? Saguna Nirakara, which means even if I'm a devotee of a specific form, there's nothing wrong with that, but with time, my mind should contemplate on this without form aspect, but with qualities aspect of God, the Saguna Nirakara. Here, Nirakara, or without form, does not necessarily mean formless, right? And I'm saying this based on what Krishna has said so far in the Gita. I'm not making this statement out of the air. Nirakara means you cannot pin him down to any one form. You cannot define an ocean with the shape of one wave, can you? The air fills a balloon, but the shape of one balloon does not define the shape of air, does it? In the same manner, when we say Nirakara, it means God's nature cannot be defined by any one form. All forms belong to him, and that is why he is Nirakara. Similarly, all qualities also arise from him. We have seen that in one of the earlier shlokas, I think in the previous chapter. But the contemplation of certain qualities prepares this mind in a certain way, and Krishna speaks about those qualities in this verse, and Swami is going to later mention why some qualities have to be contemplated upon, because all qualities, the pleasant, unpleasant, good, bad, right, wrong, whatever you think of, everything is sourced from the same Lord. But when you contemplate on a few qualities, they have a certain effect on the mind. So we will go back to the shloka, we will see what are these qualities that Krishna speaks about and specifically says when you think of God in this manner, your mind is prepared and something happens to the mind, which he's going to tell in the next verse. We will come to that when we come to that. So in this shloka, the first description he gives is Kavim. He refers to God as a Kavi, a poet. Though we use the word Kavi to mean poet in most modern languages, the word Kavi had a more generic meaning, right, in Sanskrit and even in older usage. As Swami says, Kavi is one who knows the past, present and future. How is that idea derived, and if Kavi did not mean poet then, why have we started using this word Kavi to mean a poet now? A poet is someone who can see more than what a normal person sees. Where a normal person sees a sunrise, a poet sees a deeper learning. Where someone sees a flower, the poet sees a beautiful message. And the poem is always only an expression of that insight, of that vision that this Kavi has, isn't it? One day when Swami was talking to the students, he asked, does anybody know Wordsworth? Right? We've all heard that name, William Wordsworth. So the boy said, yes, Swami, we know him. We read his poetry and he's a very famous English poet. Swami said, not just a poet, he is a great Advaitin. Now that was surprising for the boys, and they said, we only know him as an English poet and we do enjoy his poetry, but who knew that he was an Advaitin? Then Swami went on to explain one of Wordsworth's most famous poems, The Daffodils, from the point of view of Vedanta. I'm not going into the details of that, maybe we'll leave that for another time. But the point that I'm trying to drive with a small example is, for us, from the worldly point of view, he was a poet. But Swami was able to see that experience behind those words And those experiences define him more than those words. And that is why a kavi is not just a poet who gives flowery words. A kavi is one who sees more than what a regular person sees. And his poem is only a word, a verbal expression of that insight and that experience. And in the past, the word kavi was used to describe all scholars, right? Most of the scholars were referred to as kavis. One who understands the culture of the past, the present times and the needs of the present times, and he also has the farsight and accordingly guides the society. Such a person is supposed to be a scholar, right? A scholar is not somebody who is only able to retain information or able to express it in flowery ways. The one who understands the need of the present, who has imbibed the essence of the past, and who also has farsight and accordingly guides the society, he is a scholar and he is referred to as a kavi. So here Krishna says God is the supreme kavi, he who sees everything that there is to be seen. A kavi is still limited, right? Still he is able to see only what little more than others, but still his vision is limited. But God is the greatest of all kavis because he is able to see everything as it is. He is able to see the past, present and the future. And he is present within each. Right? That knowledge is present within each one of us, but it is covered by ignorance, and the process of spirituality is to uncover that. That's why Swami says, for all creation, this poet, this kavi is the motivator, the prime basis within. And then Swami makes a beautiful statement. He says, he is the poet and his poem is all this creation. So a beautiful explanation that Swami gives for this first appellation that Krishna gives to the supreme divine Kavim. The next word Krishna uses is Puranam, ancient. Swami again gives a beautiful explanation for this term. Purana means that which is old. That's the general usage that we have. But the actual meaning of the word, Swami says, is that which was new in the past. Right? It is not old, but that which was new in the distant past or in a earlier time. So I have a very old book with me. It only means it was new at a distant past. So Swami says, the Lord is Purana, but he is also Sanatana, eternal. So which means, he is new every moment. That's a very beautiful and poetic way of putting it. Purana means that which was new in the past, but because God is eternal, he is new every moment. Because at some distant future, we will look back and say, oh, he was new at some point. So which means he's new every moment. And that's why Swami says his newness also is eternal. So he is Purana, but he is also Nitya Nutana, the one who is always ever new. What a beautiful description of the Lord. He is Purana, but he is Nitya Nutana. Swami would say God is Satya Sanatana, Nitya Nutana. He is eternal, he is ancient, but he is ever new. At every moment, he is ever new. Then Krishna goes on to describe divinity as Anushasitaram. Anushasitaram, the ruler of the whole world. Swami explains this term in the Gita Vahini as independent, unchecked master. He lays down the conduct of all. The five elements execute his orders. They cannot overstep the limits laid down by him. His laws alone govern the inner world of all beings as no human law can. He operates in the regions of the mind. End of quote. And that is why he is Anushasitaram. The one who governs everything, the minutest atom, the minutest element to every aspect of creation. He is Anushasitaram, the ruler, the ordainer of everything. Then Krishna says, a beautiful term, Anoraniyam, subtler than the subtlest. This is directly from the Kathopanishad, the complete sentence in the Upanishad being anuraniyan mahato mahiyan, subtler than the subtlest, larger than the largest. We've heard this being quoted by Swami any number of times. But anuraniyan is not a reference to size, but nature. That's why it is not smaller than the smallest, but it is subtler than the subtlest. It is a reference to qualities also, right? When we speak of the panchabhutas, the five elements, we often speak of their varying subtleness. It is said that the earth is most gross, and so it does not move, it is stationary. But water is subtler than earth, so it can flow. Fire is subtler than water, so it can rise up. Air is subtler than fire too, so it spreads in all directions. But ether is subtler than all of these, and that is why ether is all pervasive. Similarly, element which is least subtle has most qualities. The earth element has all the five characteristics of shabda, rupa, rasa, gandha, right? Sound, form, sight, taste and smell. Water, which is little subtler than that, has only four qualities. Fire, which has three qualities subtler than water, it has only sound, touch and sight. And air has two qualities, that of sound and touch. And ether, which is the subtlest, has only one quality. So the most subtlest has the least qualities. So the more subtler an element becomes, more difficult it is to perceive it with the senses. So in that sense, God is subtler than the subtlest. The subtlest that we can still conceive with our senses is akasha, is ether. But the Lord is anuraniyan, subtler than the subtlest. And this is connected to another phrase or terminology which Krishna uses. We'll come to that. But this is the fourth one, anuraniyam. The fifth expression is sarvasya dhataram. The word dhataram means supporter or the basis. So sarvasya dhataram is same as sarvadhara, right? That's another word which we use for, name which we use for the Lord. So sarvasya dhataram is literally an expansion of this name that we use, sarvadhara, the one who is the adhara or the basis for everything. Once when I was doing this Answering Booth program, a small child had asked me this question on the show as to how can you prove the existence of God? A very interesting question coming from a child. Of course, I did not prove it or anything like that, but I had explained how we must look at God, right? How do we derive the existence of God, or how do we believe that there is something like God? And this is the example that I had given that child. I have a blackboard and I write something on it with a piece of chalk, right? The chalk writings are temporary, but for me to be able to write something, I need something that is more permanent, right? So in that sense, the blackboard is something that is more permanent and the writings are temporary. So the blackboard becomes the adhara, and the chalk writings are the adheya. But there is a wall. Today I have a blackboard on it. Tomorrow I might want to remove it and put a painting over there. Or I might want to remove a blackboard and put a green board. Or I might want a white screen for a projector. So when the board, the blackboard, is seen as the adheya, the temporary one, the wall becomes the adhara for this blackboard, isn't it? In that manner, if we keep going back, the wall is the adheya, the building is the adhara, the building is the adheya, the land on which it stands is the adhara, the land is, say, adheya, the earth becomes the adhara. If the earth, the planet, is the adheya, then the galaxy or the solar system in which it is becomes adhara, and so on and so forth. If you keep going back like this, So for there to be a temporary adheya, there must be something that is more permanent as the adhara. And say when you look at earth, in the same example that I gave, when you look at earth, it is not adhara only for the house, it is adhara for everything thereafter, right? For the house, the wall in the house, what you hang on the wall, what you write on that board, everything, the earth becomes the adhara for all of this. And say when you look at earth, it is not, in that manner, if you keep going back, there must be one entity that is eternal, which will then become the sarvadhara, right? I went till the point of talking about the galaxy, right? So if this entire creation becomes the adheya, then there must be something or someone who is the adhara for all of this. And that entity is sarvasya dhataram, the Lord who is sarvadhara, who is the adhara for everything, right? So that is another very, very profound and beautiful appellation for the Lord. Then Krishna says, achintya rupam, the one whose form is inconceivable. Achintya means that which cannot be thought about. Achintya rupam, the Lord's form is inconceivable. If you really look at it, being inconceivable is also given as a quality. If something is inconceivable, it means it is nirguna, it does not have qualities, and that is why it's inconceivable. But here Krishna is giving achintya as also a quality of the Lord. Being inconceivable is being given as a description of the Lord. Because we are comparing God to everything else that we know. I am able to understand other things, but God is by nature not understandable by the mind. So that becomes a quality of the Lord, right? Which I can contemplate on. We sometimes tell, you know, this friend of mine, he cannot be understood at all. Or I have a daughter, I can't understand her at all. So that becomes a quality of that person. You describe that person as someone whose actions I cannot understand, right? In the same manner, God is described as someone who cannot be understood by this mind. A few months back when we were discussing about meditation, I had mentioned the experience of a devotee, just like the experience of Romal sir that I described. This was again another very fascinating experience. I will not go into all the details because I think narrated it in quite elaborate details last time. So I'll just give you a brief of that. One day he was just wondering, you know, Swami had initiated him into meditation, Swami had told him how to meditate and all that. And at one point he was sitting for darshan, for Swami, waiting for Swami, and he started thinking to himself, Swami, how do I meditate on you? Because to meditate on you, my mind has to think about you, and the Vedas describe you as achintya, inconceivable. Then in what way can I think of you and how to meditate on you? And this became a thought of obsession and kept on going up, I mean, going round and round in his mind. And he sat for many hours in this thought. Swami, how do I think of you? How do I think of you? You're achintya. You are inconceivable. How do I think of you? And just before Swami was coming for darshan, almost like a sudden flash of insight, it came to his thinking, ha, think of God as inconceivable and meditate on him. Think of God as being achintya and meditate on him. And he realized that is the true meditation. And he was so filled with joy with his insight coming from within, and to kind of corroborate it and or to complete that entire beautiful experience that he had, Swami walks up to him and Swami speaks other things and then looks at him and says, did you get your answer? Answer mila? Swami asks him. Almost by hinting that it was me who gave that answer to you. So achintya rupam is also a quality of God. The absence of quality which makes him inconceivable is also a quality of God. So though the shloka is not yet over, we have not yet completed all the descriptions that Krishna gives, but in Gita Vahini, Swami explains each of these terms so elaborately, right? when Krishna says it in the shloka, it is just one word. But most of these descriptions that I'm giving you are the descriptions that Swami has given in Gita Vahini as Krishna's descriptions given to Arjuna. So you can imagine Krishna describing some of these things in such detail, and Swami writes that at this point, Arjuna becomes a bit restless. And Arjuna says, and Swami writes, I quote, "At this, Arjuna pleaded with Krishna thus, 'Lord, please let us proceed. Time is running fast. We cannot be stationary in this battlefield without assuming responsibility or making a decision. War is facing us with open jaws, ready to swallow and overwhelm. I am ready to obey the instructions you may be pleased to give me. Only let there be no delay. Hence, quickly enlighten me about the 7th attribute of this Saguna Nirakara.'" End of quote. So Swami gives us the scene as it happens with Arjuna's inner feelings and emotions and his restlessness, right? So that is why Gita Vahini is so special for all of us, and we're so happy to go through that simultaneously. So Krishna continues with the qualities of the Lord that he's been describing. Krishna says, "Aditya Varnam Tamasah Parastat." Again, a statement many of us must be familiar with, Aditya Varnam Tamasah Parastat, because it appears in the Purusha Suktam. And how many times we have had this pleasure of sitting before Swami and voicing out these names of the Lord, Aditya Varnam Tamasah Parastat. So going back to the descriptions, the first phrase, Aditya Varnam, is one terminology, Tamasah Parastat is one other terminology. Aditya Varnam means with the splendor of the sun as his complexion. Aditya Varnam. The sun has two qualities. One is it is self-effulgent, and whenever in the scriptures God is equated with the sun, Aditya, this is one quality it makes a reference to. Swami would often say in his discourses that the Atma is like the sun and the mind is like the moon. The reason he would give that is the Atma, which is divine, is self-effulgent, whereas the moon borrows its effulgence from the sun, and similarly the mind too borrows its effulgence and enlightenment from the Atman, right? So whenever this description of God being the sun is given, it is always a reference, or invariably a reference, to this nature of it being self-effulgent. The other quality is an extension of this. You don't see the sun through any other agent or light, but you see everything that you see because of the sun. As they say, you don't need a torchlight to see the sun. You see the sun as it is. You see the sun in its light, right? Say I wake up in the morning and I want to see if the sun is up. I don't have to go out and see the sun to see whether it is up. I just have to part my curtains, and if I see that the whole landscape is well lit, I know that the sun is up, right? So if everything is bright and visible, it means the sun is shining. So too, even though we may not see God, know God, and experience God right now in our present state of mind, the very fact that we are able to see anything, we are able to feel anything or experience anything, it is an indication that God shines, right? If I go out, I mean, just go out of the studio and I'm able to see the trees being green and the grass being lush, it means the sun is shining, right? I don't have to see the sun to say that it's a bright day. I just have to see things around to tell you that it's a bright day. In the same manner, the very fact that we are able to experience, we are able to understand and learn and gather knowledge, it is a sign that there is God shining. And that is why God is equated with the sun and described as Aditya Varnam. The last description in this verse is Tamasah Parastat, the one who is beyond darkness. God is often described as he who illumines darkness, right? A very poetic expression. God is the light that illumines darkness. Technically speaking, there is nothing like darkness. Darkness is not an entity at all. It is only defined by the absence of light, isn't it? So in a sense, it is light that defines darkness. Darkness does not have an existence of its own. Only when there is an absence of light, there is something called darkness. Swami explains this in the Gita Vaini in the following way, and I think I'll just quickly quote that portion. Swami says, Arjuna, just close your eyes for a moment. What do you experience? Complete darkness, right? How did you know that it is dark? You cannot see darkness. Then how did you announce that there was darkness there? Two entities are there. Darkness and the one who sees the darkness, right? If you are yourself darkness, how can you see the darkness? No, you are the seer, so you are not darkness. Darkness is that which is seen. The seer is you. You are the witness. Now consider another fact. People very often condemn themselves as ignoramuses. But if they really were ignoramuses or fools, how could they recognize their own ignorance? From where did people get that knowledge? When did that wisdom enter? And how? Ignorance or ajnana is the seen. The inner wisdom or jnana is the seer. You are the vision, drik, that sees the object, drishya, or ignorance. In the same way, all the eight descriptions above have to be contemplated upon. That is the correct meditation of the form of the Lord. End of quote. The moment you say God is inconceivable, every description you give of him after that is inaccurate, right? Because after telling that he cannot be described, we are describing. So every description that follows is an inaccurate description, is a false description. Like the experiment once a visually impaired person did. This person was visually impaired from birth. So he would walk up to people and he would ask them, can you describe the color red to me? Can you describe the color blue to me? Imagine a person who has never seen colors, who does not know what the concept of colors is. And he says, can you describe what is red? Can you describe what is blue? What is green? What is yellow? Each person was only able to speak of these colors in association with something, right? You can describe blue through water. You can describe blue through the sky. Or you can describe a color like red through the emotions of attention, of fear, right? But none of the descriptions that you give like this is actually a description of the color. Because there is no way you can describe color to a person who's never seen color. In that sense, every description we come up with in this mind is not the right description of God, and God is beyond darkness, and this mind represents that darkness. That is why tamasah parastat, he is beyond darkness. He is beyond this mind. But as Krishna says, these eight descriptions must be contemplated and meditated upon. And that itself becomes an Abhyasa Yoga. The one phrase that I left out in that shloka is Sam Anusmaret Yaha, meaning the one who performs Anusmarana of all these. As I said, these descriptions are all what can be found in the Upanishads. And these are all a result of very deep inquiry. So the process of contemplating on these itself is a means to have the mind prepared in a certain manner that it will turn to God in the last moments. And this statement, Sam Anusmara, is again an important instruction of Vedanta, the second step in the process of Shravana, Manana and Nididhyasana. Right? This is the process which is given as the sadhana that needs to be performed. You first perform Shravana, listen to these truths from great masters or from the scriptures, and then you perform Manana, constant contemplation. That is what is referred to as Sam Anusmarana. Taking the truths and then contemplating on them, and that prepares the mind. And Krishna is going to reiterate that in the following verse, and he's going to complete. As I said, it was only half the statement. this shloka stands for. He's going to complete that and he's going to take it forward in the next verse. I think we will complete that. I am running out of time, but it would be incomplete without doing that shloka. So I'll just take 5-10 minutes more and I'll complete that before we conclude today's program.
Prayana kale manasachalena bhaktya yukto yoga balena chaiva bhruvor madhye pranamaveshya samyak satam param purusham upaiti divyam.
At the time of death, with an unshaken mind endowed with devotion, by the power of yoga, fixing the whole life breath in the middle of the two eyebrows, he reaches the resplendent Supreme Person. So that is the 10th verse of the 8th chapter. As I had mentioned last week, Krishna goes into some of the processes of yoga here. What he says in this shloka is not necessarily an instruction to be practiced, at least in my opinion, but a description of the final moments of someone who is about to reach the supreme state, right? The previous shloka was one that is literally like a task, right? You can take it up and you can practice. And Swami said that these 8 qualities must be meditated upon. If one does this for many, many years, what happens to such a person at the time of death? I think that Krishna explains here. And again, this is mentioned in the scriptures where yogis are described. So this is also directly from many of the Upanishads. So Krishna says, Prayana kale, at the time of death, manasa achalena, with the mind unshaken, bhaktya yuktaha, endowed with devotion, yoga balena cha, and by the power of yoga, pranam aveshya samyak, having placed the prana properly, bhruvoho madhye, at the middle of the two eyebrows, saha upaiti, he reaches tam, that param purusham divyam, supreme divine person. A crisp description of the yogic way of giving up one's life. That's what it is. In fact, Adi Shankara in his commentary explains this or elaborates this process a little more by saying that the mind is first concentrated and controlled and brought to the heart, the hridaya, the right side of the heart to be more precise. And this is actually spoken of as the seat of this feeling of I or aham, right? This is often referred to as the hridaya kuhara, the cave of the heart. And that is where this feeling of I emanates from, it is said. And that's why even while uttering prayer, it is always, Swami would say that it has to come from the heart, right? This is the heart that Swami refers to. So concentrating the mind in this place means to contemplate on this aham, this atma. Then the prana is slowly raised through the nadi and placed in the region between the eyebrows, bhruvoho madhye. And in such a state, when a person leaves the body, one certainly reaches God, is what Krishna says. As I just mentioned, this is a yogic practice that is being validated here, but can this really be practiced? There are a few hints that Krishna drops in the shloka that we can pick. For example, how to attain the state is explained in a manner, but how to have that steadiness of the mind and how to place it in the heart within. But for the rest of the things as a practice, I think that's a different path altogether. That need not necessarily be something that needs to be practiced. It's as I said, just a description. We discussed a couple of episodes back about the nature of the last moments, right? How for the mind it could be one of the most restless and stressful moments. But if the mind has not been prepared for it, it becomes even more restless. That's why here Krishna says, Manasa achalena bhaktya yukto yoga balena chaiva. The mind is made achala through the strength of yoga and bhakti. It's a very beautiful statement. Manasa achalena. The mind which has been made steady, how? Bhaktya yukto, through the focus of bhakti, yoga balenacha, through the power of yoga. What is this bhakti? Swami explains in Gita Vahini in this manner. He says, I shall tell you briefly what devotion consists of. Listen. Devotion is the complete identification of one's mental activities with those of the ideal on which the attachment is centered. And that is why these qualities are mentioned here by Krishna. So the mind can contemplate on these. This point Swami says that Arjuna asks, Krishna, is it really possible to focus on God in this manner? And Swami writes Krishna's response as follows, and he says, I quote, it is possible, Arjuna. Control the senses. Let the mind be effaced as much as possible. Let the heart be purified. Let the vital airs be uplifted into the highest region of the head. Let the individual be established in the atmic truth. And let Om be the only point of attention at the moment the breath leaves the body. One who does this comes to me and joins with me. Their mental activities become the same as mine, said Krishna. End of quote. The portion about chanting Om, we will come to that next week, because the next two shlokas are going to focus on this, taking the word Om at the time of death. But one point which Swami makes clear in Gita Vaini is, it is not that you have to chant Om through your mouth in those last moments. Om has to be contemplated on in the mind, right? So in this part in Gita Vaini, Swami actually speaks about another aspect which is very important, and that is control of the senses. Swami says, note the point, it is control of the senses and not destruction of it. Each sense must be used to perform that particular task that it should perform, and it should not be allowed to become the master. Right? That's what it means by saying control of the senses. There are regulations for how each of the senses need to be used, and Swami says that they have to be used accordingly. Swami would often say in his discourses that the senses are like doorways to our home. They are like doors. The function of the doors that the doors play to our homes is what the senses have to be playing to our mind and our inner faculties. Swami would say that the doors are meant to let people inside, and it is also meant to stop people from coming inside. So it is to regulate the entry of people and also the regulation of time and situation when you want to allow whom inside. So Swami says that these doors are meant for you to use your own discrimination. Similarly, the senses are meant to enable you with this choice and discrimination. Swami says, ask yourself what broadens your heart and what breeds disquiet in the heart. Swami says that this is the touchstone that needs to be used as to what you will let enter inside and what you will not let inside. What makes you feel broad in your heart? What broadens your vision? And what breeds disquiet in the heart? Avoid the latter and foster the former. That's what Swami says. And the best way to approach this, Swami says, is through devotion. Though all of these descriptions that Krishna gives, and the middle of the eyebrow, the moment it is said, some of us get scared. The moment the word nadi is used, some of us get scared, self-included. But Krishna repeatedly reminds us that the method that can be used is bhakti, right? There's nothing more effective than that. And we will see that after all these descriptions, again, Krishna is going to point out to that, and he says, think of me all the time, that is more than enough, you will reach me, right? But that thinking must also be true to the nature of God. I'm sure there are any number of episodes from Swami's life and experiences of devotees that can be mentioned for each of these names that Krishna has given for the Lord, right? We can take and we can say that, see, Swami explained this. Just like I said that Achintya Rupam, that experience, like that, I'm sure any number of devotees have had experiences for each of these descriptions. But if I start exploring that and if I start going into that, we will never ever complete Bhagavad Gita. And already there are a few people who have complained that at the pace at which you are doing your Bhagavad Gita, it's going to take many, many years before you complete it. So I will not go into that. But I'm just saying that there is enough. Swami has given experiences to so many devotees, and these experiences are our experiences. It might not be to me, right? Some of these things did not happen to you or me, but it has happened to somebody like you and me. And that is an indication that Swami is giving all of us an inspiration and a prodding that Swami is giving us that you can get there, you can do all these and get there. So anyway, before I conclude, let me repeat those 8 terms that describe God, which Swami so clearly said, if contemplated constantly upon, all the attachments and afflictions of this mind will just wither away and the mind will naturally focus on God in those last moments. So before I conclude, I will quickly mention those 8 names and their meanings again, and we'll conclude with that. The first name was Kavim, all-knowing one. Puranam, the ancient and eternal one. Anushasitaram, the ordainer of all things. Anuraniyam, subtler than the subtlest. Sarvasya dhataram, the basis, the adhara of all things. Achintya rupam, one whose form is inconceivable. Aditya varnam, with the splendor of the sun as his complexion, the one who is self-effulgent, and all things become known because of him. Tamasah parastat, the one who is beyond all darkness, who makes known even darkness. So these are those 8 very beautiful terms that were used by Krishna to describe that supreme being. And he said, this is how God has to be thought about, and this is how Anusmarana has to be performed. So with that, dear listeners, I'll conclude this week's episode. Thank you for joining me again this week. I most humbly offer this at Bhagavan's lotus feet. I'll meet you all next week for the resumption of this triune pilgrimage at 10 a.m. on another beautiful Thursday. I'll meet you again shortly at 12 p.m. today for the afternoon satsang with Brother Arvind. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Bishu for the next episode. Till I meet you at 12, take care. Jai Sai Ram. I'll meet you again next week, 10 a.m. for the Gita series. Sai Ram.